please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfold, Judge Siegel, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Diane B. Bratfold presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Again, good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So today's date is April 11th, 2024. Our oral argument calendar before this panel has a total of 5 matters. 3 of those are oral, and I see the lawyers are here at council table for the first case. So I'll ask the marshal to call the first case, please. Thank you.
First case is number 823-1460. Galaxy Wireless LLC respondent versus Western National Mutual Insurance Company appellant.
And I'll say just a few quick things before we start the argument, and they may well be things that you're all well aware of. First of all, I'll point out to you that the podium is adjustable, and when you go to the podium, feel free to make adjustments, you know, for your height so that the microphone's at a comfortable level. It goes up and down, so you can make that adjustment as well. And then just take your time to settle in whatever materials you need to be available. Before you do start your remarks, we ask you to please identify yourself as well as the client you represent, even though all of that is clear to us in the materials. And the reason we do that is that today's proceedings are maintained on the court's website as an audio recording. And so that way our audio recording is very clear. And then with that, I'd also ask you to keep your eye on the clock. That is visible to you on the podium. Each side is 15 minutes, 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant chooses. And the time tends to go quickly. We really enjoy having the conversation with you. So with that, counsel for appellant, if you're ready, we are ready to hear you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel Chuck Spivak on behalf of appellant Western National Mutual Insurance Company. Your honors, if there were ever a case where a jury's verdict needed to be set aside and either a different result entered or a new trial ordered, this is it. This is a fire loss case listing the litany of false statements that were made by the respondent about what was lost in that fire would consume most of my argument time. What's critical here is that the amount of the jury's verdict confirms that at least one of those claims was patently false. And the trial court, however, refused to impose the proper outcome based upon that jury's finding, the entry of judgment for the defendant. It also, on its own, changed the dynamic of the trial of truth versus fraud by interjecting the concept of honest mistake where no such honest mistake was claimed as the justification for the erroneous numbers submitted to the jury. On top of this, the trial court instructed the jury to disregard the most compelling factual evidence offered at trial confirming the respondent's duplicity, that of Peter Dahl, on grounds that come nowhere close to constituting the proper exercise of discretion. And to add icing to the cake, the trial court allowed the jury to hear highly prejudicial evidence that a non-party witness collected insurance for his losses at this fire on the basis of the non-existent read, not a thin read, a non-existent read, that this evidence might somehow show that the witness actually didn't like the respondents, making his damaging testimony about them somehow less powerful than it would have been had the jury been left with the impression that he did.
Counsel, among the parade of horribles that you've just identified, which is the strongest argument?
The strongest argument, Your Honor, is the fact that the jury verdict itself confirms that there was fraud in the submission of this claim to Western National Insurance
Company. Well,
when you
say fraud, I mean, there is a difference between saying something that might not be accurate and having an intent to mislead.
Your Honor, in this circumstance where there was no attempt to argue that this may be rough, we don't know for sure, but adamant, obstinate that this was the amount and rejected by the jury, that is evidence of fraud, fraud that includes the intent to deceive. And this just isn't me saying this.
Well, the Minnesota. Why is that? I mean, isn't it within the province of the fact finder to distinguish between someone's ill intent and someone's honest mistake, even if you don't call it an honest mistake or ill intent?
Not in a situation, Your Honor, where there is no basis for the fact finder to find a number different than what the policyholder presented as the absolute true statement. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized this, and it's recognized this going back to 1910 and is holding Hodge versus Flanker Insurance Company, that a large discrepancy between a claimed value and the actual damage determined by the jury is itself evidence of fraud. Here's what happened here, Your Honor. They say they swore and were adamant that they incurred $445,000 in tenant improvement losses. That claim was mainly made up of work that turned out to have been performed by the landlord, not by the tenant, and for which the tenant paid nothing. They never wavered from this position at trial.
I thought there was some testimony at trial that, at least on cross, there was some representation that the building owner made the improvements, and then on cross-examination, it was revealed that perhaps that maybe the tenant had made certain of the improvements or some subset of the improvements.
There was zero evidence that there was $445,000 paid by the tenants, and there was no delineation that was offered to the jury as to what subset of that $445,000 was paid.
But then doesn't it fall within the province of the fact finder to make a decision as to what that subset may have been based on the description of the improvements that were made? I mean, it does seem to me like the fact finder, the jurors, could have cobbled together this $100,000 verdict based on the testimony that was provided, even if a number wasn't expressly provided to the jury.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. There was no evidence breaking down this $445,000 in a way that the fact finder could have pulled $100,000 out of the ether without engaging in speculation and conjecture. And the Minnesota Supreme Court, in its 1977 case of Bush versus Bush Construction, said that a jury may not base an award of substantial damages on speculation and conjecture. There was nothing that was offered to this jury that would allow them to conclude that, in fact, they had only paid for $100,000, not $445,000. The position of the respondents was it was $445,000 or nothing. The position of the appellant was that that was clearly made up of stuff they didn't pay for. They swore that they incurred $445,000 in tenant improvement costs. It turns out they didn't. They never wavered from that position at trial. They never conceded that if its number was inflated, it was an honest mistake. They never offered a breakdown that would allow the jury to find something other than the $445,000.
So can I turn your attention back to a minute? You were the 1910 case is this Hodge case?
That's correct,
Your
Honor.
I've got it right in front of me, and it says that it remains a question of fact whether the valuation was intentionally fraudulent or merely an error of judgment. So where in this case does it say if a jury finds misrepresentation that that equates to an intent to deceive and defraud?
Your Honor reads Hodge correctly, but the facts of Hodge omitted one specific fact that's available here. And that is, there is absolutely no basis other than speculation or conjecture.
So the case doesn't actually say that. You're saying under the facts of this case, where they're putting together a value that there was, and they didn't argue, look, this could have been an honest mistake. Now that I've heard Mark Simon's testimony, I mean, I'm just trying to understand your argument here.
Our position, Your Honor, is that given respondents' obstinance about the amount and the lack of evidence that would have allowed a finding of a lower amount not based upon fraud with an intent to deceive, the only conclusion that can be drawn from this jury's verdict on these facts is that Galaxy intentionally misrepresented its tenant improvement losses with the intent to defraud.
So can I ask you another question? So there were two separate questions on the special verdict form. One about was there misrepresentation, and the next was about the intent to deceive, the fraud. So did you object to having two separate questions on the special verdict form?
There was no objection to the two separate questions on the special verdict form, but there was an objection to the manner in which the jury was instructed.
Right.
Goes to the error in the manner in which the jury answered the second question on the special verdict form. So the error with regard to the manner in which the jury was instructed was that it's correct that there are two elements, both under statute and in the insurance policy, There has to be a willful or intentional misstatements calculated to deceive the insurer in order to avoid the policy. But the court went beyond that. The court instructed the jury that honest mistakes do not void the policy. And when it
but
did
that is the law, correct?
You know, it's the law if there's evidence to support it. And our argument is that it's not the question as to whether the special verdict question was improper. The question is whether the jury was instructed to, in a way such that it answered that special verdict question according to an improper instruction on the law as related to the facts. So honest mistake is clearly a defense, but honest mistake has to be proven in order to, or at least submitted in order
but
to
the
justify
burden of proof
the instruction.
Is on your client. I mean, you have the burden of proof on the fraud, voiding the policy, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
We think the jury provided that for us in ample amount. Getting back to this instruction issue, again, it's correct that only willful and intentional misstatements calculated to deceive the insurer operate to void the policy. But when the court instructed the jury that honest mistakes do not void the policy, when it did that, it interjected a concept that wasn't in this trial.
Counsel,
honest mistake.
Where in the record is the objection to the jury instruction?
Your Honor, I can't cite to the appendix page, but I know that we addressed that specifically in our opening brief.
I mean, it seems to me that there was a charge conference that was off the record, and then the jury was instructed, and I didn't see this specific objection. Maybe I missed it. Anywhere in the record?
Again, Your Honor, the specific page to the record I can't provide to the court standing here right now, but I know this issue was brought up and it was addressed specifically in our opening brief, preemptively, not in our response brief. And we believe the record is clear that there was a preserved objection to this honest mistake concept.
So, counsel, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the honest mistake argument and whether the record here supports the district court's instruction. So it seems to me that the record here is unique. I haven't had time to look at the details of the Bush case, but is that a fire case?
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, I don't recall.
Yeah. So, honest mistake, I think, can take a bunch of different forms. Now, that's just my off the top of my head thinking. And feel free to correct me based on your knowledge of the law. But honest mistake could be innocent. It could also be a mistake based on the circumstances. So in a fire case, it's very difficult to determine what the damages were. And I think we've all read the record in this case in terms of understanding how this site was, you know, physically dangerous and there was people were unable to access it for a period of time. And you may want to now segue over to your evidentiary issue, and I can see why you'd want to do that, but stick with me for a minute.
Sure.
All right? So this is a case where the jury was well aware of the circumstances, the fire, the devastation, the difficulty accessing the scene. So the fact that it was hard to determine the amount of improvements that were the value of the improvements put into the property by the tenant, and that was all disputed to begin with. You know, it's, you know, the fact that this is a fire loss case factors in, doesn't it? And I apologize for the length of my question, but it just seems to me you're trying to take out a very isolated aspect of honest mistake and not looking at the entire circumstances that were submitted to the jury.
Yeah, no need to apologize about the length of the question, Your Honor, because it's a good question and it fits right into exactly what we're arguing. We understand that the concept of honest mistake does exist in the connection with fire cases. And there may be an honest mistake, for example, as to how many cell phones were actually on the premises, and maybe not all of them were found in the excavation. But here we're talking about tenant improvements. And the value of tenant improvements isn't based upon what you find in the wreckage.
But they lost the documents, counsel, right? I mean, that's what I remember reading in this record.
There were no documents that were put into the record that would show that this tenant paid $445,000 in tenant improvements. And that's not based upon after-the-fact examination of the record. That's based upon ledgers, credit card statements, checks that were written, invoices from contractors that would prove that before the fire even happened, the tenant incurred $445,000 worth of tenant improvements, and there was no such evidence put into the record.
There are other ways of proving the value of improvements, and one is to have simple photographs, right, of the improvements, or to be, for a jury to be able to see later constructed evidence of those improvements. And, you know, counsel, that's not possible in a total devastation fire case, right?
I guess, Your Honor,
I mean, I've tried to do it personally. It's very, very difficult, so.
I can't disagree with Your Honor's concept, but I do disagree with Your Honor's premise that when talking about tenant improvements, as opposed to the loss of materials that were contained on the site during the fire, that anything having to do with the examination of the wreckage after the fire take place is in any way probative of an honest mistake. Tenant improvements are incurred before the fire takes place, and they should be able to be documented as to what was spent as tenant improvements. They claim $445,000 worth of them, and it turns out the jury didn't believe them and offered only $100,000 with no basis for the jury to pick $100,000 out of the air. And that brings us to our fallback argument with regard to, look, if we're not going to get judgment as a matter of law on the basis of the jury's verdict, at least conclude that the jury pulling that $100,000 out of the ether was speculative. There was nothing in the record that itemized that $444,000 expenditure so that the jury could conclude, based upon the evidence presented to it of the examination of the record, that there was $100,000 paid for by this insured that was damaged in the fire. That was purely a number that was plucked from the air. And the Minnesota Supreme Court, again, in Bush versus Bush Construction, 1977 case, said a jury may not base an award of substantial damages on speculation and conjecture. Okay. So, Your Honor, I've already talked about the error in the jury instruction on honest mistake. Where there is no evidence to support a particular theory, there should be no instruction on it. That's Doherty versus May Brothers, 1963 decision, Minnesota Supreme Court, and there was no evidence here to support honest mistake. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Edward Beckman on behalf of Respondent Galaxy Wireless. May it please the court. With respect to the appeal that has been filed by Western National and the arguments just made, the contractual obligation of my client post-fire was to properly estimate the amount of loss, and it did it the best it could at trial. There was photography from 3 years before the fire showing the building before tenant improvements, after tenant improvements, and my client's testimony, his best recollection of what he paid. He also testified that he can't produce documents lost in the fire and unavailable to him. The record is that he did not have access to the site thereafter, and there were records lost, and the photography well establishes the intensity of this fire, and the record well establishes where the records were kept and the fire in that location.
I mean, so, counsel, the records that would demonstrate improvements to the property would not necessarily exclusively be held on the premises. So if your clients paid for improvements, one would assume that there might be bank records showing transactions, or you could go to the contractors that perform the improvements and receive records from them. And I think the argument from your esteemed colleague is that there was just a dearth of evidence that would substantiate the award that was that the jury gave $100,000 for these improvements. How do you address that?
I think my client's credibility was enhanced and is demonstrated with the jury by how the jury made an award for the other coverages. And there was ample photography about the contents in the basement, how much the value of those contents were. The money in the securities, that was a $10,000 award, that was just based on my client's testimony because he didn't have access to the site. And so there is the totality of the evidence over this four-day trial, and I think that built up my client's credibility when he testified he didn't have records and didn't know, you know, where these subcontractors were located anymore. But we did have photographs of them actually doing some of the work. So with respect to our cross appeal about the summary judgment order that denied our motion to declare a total loss.
Let's turn back to one of appellant's arguments is that there's no basis in the record at all or evidence from which the jury could have said, no, it's not 445,000 because we don't, we heard Simon's testimony and he said, yeah, that wasn't, that was paid for by me, not your client. So we'll just do 100,000. I mean, that does seem speculative. There was no breakdown, there was no, so what's your response to that?
Sure. Mr. Simon also testified on the second day of his testimony that some of the improvements that we alleged were indeed.
No, I saw that. Let, focus just on dollars. Was any evidence put in at trial tying different improvements to, you know, different dollar amounts that were paid? Because obviously the jury kind of, you know, they heard Simon's testimony and they said, oh, well, yeah, some of this was done by your client, by Galaxy Wireless. But it's the amount. Wait, how did they come up with 100,000? As I understand Western National's argument, that's complete, you know, spitball speculation, and it damages do need to be based on some kind of evidence.
Sure. My client testified to what he recalls paying 3 years before the fire, and I can see that that was in total amount. He could not recall exactly what was paid for, you know, let's say the ceiling or the flooring or whatever. So he did not provide testimony that he couldn't recall. But neither did Western National choose to proffer any testimony about valuation either. So it was my client's.
The burden is on you, on your client, to prove damages. So why shouldn't we throw out the $100,000 as just being spitball in the air? We believe some of these improvements were made, but not all of them. Maybe that's like a fourth, so we'll just give $100,000. Why is, what authority do you base your, do you counter Western National's argument?
Sure. In the case law, there is authority for the idea a witness, a property owner, can testify to how much he paid for something, and that's exactly what my client did. And then the contractual obligation here, which is my client's burden, is to estimate his loss. The proof of loss that counsel, my colleague, relies on so much just asks for an aggregate number. And so he gave the aggregate number in the proof of loss, and then he went to trial and did the same thing. So that is a fulfillment of the contractual obligation to do the estimating, to basically to respond to what they asked for. He did it at trial, and that is sufficient under this contract. The contractual requirement was to estimate everything, and that's what he did. And so if he doesn't come to trial and then further enumerate the price of the flooring tiles versus the drywall and so forth, I respectfully suggest that that is something Western National needs to do. They need to go to trial with an expert and say, okay, these photographs indicate lesser amounts, but my client fulfilled his contractual obligation. So with respect to our cross appeal for overturning the lower court's order on summary judgment with respect to a total loss, two statutes at play, 65A.08 and 65A.01. 08 is the one that specifically talks about when there's a total loss, policy limits are paid. Most of the briefing, the case law centers on 65A.01 because that's the one reference to a building. And so our argument is twofold. First of all, it doesn't say there needs to be demolition of a complete building. It doesn't say the insurance must cover an entire building or a complete building. That would read something into the statute. Not there.
So I'm not an expert in fire insurance, and certainly don't pretend to be. So it seems to me that from my understanding of total loss under the fire insurance policy statute, that there has to be some agreement as to what the value was. I don't see that in your policy. I see policy limit. Now, that could be a naive, you know, question. We've got staff attorneys, you know, we could consult with and other experts, but I just don't see that in your policy. And I know the statute is the statute, but it presumes that there's some kind of almost a liquidated damages amount for a total loss. And I just don't see that in your policy. It's all about value. I don't think you have a policy covering total loss of a building.
So I would like to address that in two ways. First, the contract, which is the focus of the court's question, and then the statute. The contract has a Minnesota amendment, and it applies to all of coverage A. And the Minnesota amendment has multiple references to a total loss and indeed a constructive total loss. That absolutely applies to coverage A. And on the first page of coverage A, which is quoted in our opening brief, we see the first page of coverage A, and that includes tenant improvements. So if the Minnesota amendment, it most certainly applies to coverage A and tenant improvements. So
is it your argument that even though the jury obviously did not believe that your client spent $445,000 for tenant improvements, they believed that your client spent $100,000, that you're supposed to get the policy limits regardless of what your proof is because of the statute?
And the statute and the contract. So we have...
That seems like a significant windfall to your client.
Sure.
And so how do you reconcile that reading as a reasonable reading of this statute?
Sure. The case law does say that total loss statute is indeed a liquidated damages statute. The legislature liquidated damages in instances where a building is annihilated. So... our point is, and it's really remarkable when you read the Minnesota Amendment, no longer in the total loss scenario does the insured have to value the property lost because the valuation has been set. And so our argument is that we have a building that was annihilated, and we should not have had to go through the exercise of trying to value what was lost. And I think if you look at the photography, you can see the intent of the statute, the photography in this case. Okay. Very intense fire. Then the city of Minneapolis comes and brings three stories, collapses three stories down. The exercise of trying to value a building that's been annihilated was eliminated by the legislature and Western National in its policy when it said that when there is a total loss, one need not value what was lost because it's so difficult. How does one do that? So the focus in the briefing, and I think at the district court level, was that because of this reference to a building in 65A01, my client doesn't attain coverage. But I respectfully suggest that factually speaking, okay, the event to trigger a total loss, which is annihilation of a building, happened. So in order to avoid the statutory requirement, we have to conclude that an entire building must be covered. But the statute doesn't say that, certainly not 65A01, which is the form policy language. But the primary statute is not that statute. It's a little bit of a, the primary consideration, Your Honors, is 65A08. And it simply says that when there is a total loss, we have liquidated damages and policy limits are paid. And that's why my client, we did a motion for summary judgment so my client could avoid having to go to trial and have this extremely difficult burden of proof when a building is annihilated. That's the point of total loss. And that's why I asked the court that when it comes to tenant improvements, because we do have an annihilated building, that the policy limits for that coverage are indeed triggered. And then finally, with the time remaining, just real briefly about the interest statute. This is 60A.0811. That is a different statute than some of the case law we've had in the last few years arising from Minnesota Statute 54909. Now, under 54909, the event that triggers interest is a written notice of loss. But that's not how 60A.0811 is written. There, it's calculated from the date the request for payment of those benefits was made. It doesn't have to be in writing, and it doesn't have to say an amount. And so the testimony at trial was that 3 days after the fire, my individual from my client met with David Nils, an independent adjuster for Western National, and there was a discussion, and my client certainly requested benefits under the policy, and then Mr. Nils says, oh, we need this documentation, and we need that documentation. Mr. Nils testified on day two at page 126 that on October 17, the insurer did provide documentation, but so two things. First of all, it's that meeting that triggers interest under 60A0811, and it's an error of law to use the 54909 analysis because that's a different statute, and that's a different triggering event. Or if we are going to insist that it be something in writing where there's...
But the logic of it, I'm not following your logic, because the logic of prejudgment interest is that there's an amount. So until your client tells the insurance company, this is the amount of our loss, how can there be prejudgment interest to an unknown sum? I mean, I don't know how you read that into the statute, I guess. I mean, until you say, yeah, I lost whatever it is, you know, $10 million. They don't know what they're supposed to pay. They're not the ones with the knowledge of the inventory. And the other elements, for which your client was insured. So how does that attach to an unknown number? I mean, that's what you're arguing, is that as soon as that fire happened and you called the insurance company and said, hey, there was a fire, I've been wiped out, that prejudgment interest attaches from that date?
Well, the argument is based on the terms of the statute. We've never had an appellate court interpret how payment is triggered or what's the triggering event.
Well, the statute says a request for payment of those benefits. So when you notify the insurance company of the fire, that notice did not include a request for payment of those benefits. The benefits were not identified, and there wasn't a request for payment at the time, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Mr. Nils testified on day two, page 126, that he felt that there was a total loss. So at least on tenant improvements, I think that would trigger. And indeed, if the court finds a total loss, then for that $500,000, the statute would be triggered. And then I could concede Your Honor's point that in terms of contents where a total loss wouldn't apply, then perhaps October 17th is the proper date, and that's the date Mr. Nils testifies at that same portion of the transcript where documentation on contents was indeed provided. So there is a definite number. The district court used the January 2019 date because that's the proof of loss and that's a more total enumeration. But I respectfully request that in this scenario that that's not appropriate. It's the dates that I've suggested, and I'm out of time. So, of course, I have more to say, but I am out of time, and I thank the court for its time.
Yeah, thank you, counsel. Any other questions from the panel? No? Okay, thank you. And, counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I hope I don't need all of it, Your Honor. Your Honors, respondent's contention that the jury's verdict on the other elements of damages somehow enhanced the credibility of the respondent and thus allowed for this whole idea that perhaps there was an honest mistake or whatever other justifications being made for the fact that the jury didn't accept what was vehemently asked for and instead imposed a number that had no basis in the record really draws into focus the error of the court in excluding the testimony of Peter Dahl, and that the court abuse its discretion in eliminating Mr. Dahl's testimony from the jury's consideration?
I mean, I have some serious concerns about that. I mean, interrogatory 2 asked for the identity of fact witnesses, and there was no answer to that question. And then during during a deposition, there was an inquiry about Mr. Dahl's opinions, and that was shut down as work product. So it does strike me as a huge blindside to put him on the stand and then elicit testimony that is at least touching on some of his expertise. And so I'm having a hard time, given that collection of events, understanding how the district court abused its discretion and said, you know what, saying, you know what, I'm not going to allow this.
I hope, Your Honor, that upon further reflection, you find it easier to deal with this argument
well,
that you're
you can
doing
help
right
me.
Now.
Maybe you can help me.
The problem is, Your Honor, and your focus on the objection on work product, Mr. Dahl was very clearly identified as not being offered as an expert witness. And just because he had expertise in certain area did not disqualify him from being an observer and to testifying as to what he saw in terms of what was in the rubble.
But he was not identified by your client in the interrogatories as a fact witness. I understand he was in the initial disclosures, but the interrogatories follow the initial disclosures and ask specifically, who's testifying at trial? And he's not listed.
Well, he was in our witness list. He was also in answer to interrogatory number 4, because interrogatory number 4 said the people with knowledge also include those people identified in the initial disclosures. And it's also undisputed that when there was a motion in limine that was brought to preclude Mr. Dahl's testimony as an expert.
I think you're talking about interrogatory number 5.
And I thought it was 4.
I think it's 5. And there are some people who are listed, but he's not one of them.
There is an interrogatory number 4. I believe it's interrogatory number 4. There is a statement that indicates that all those people identified in the initial disclosures are also those with knowledge of facts concerning this claim. And then I would also ask the court to look at what was done pre-trial early on with regard to the motion in limine, because there was a motion in limine brought to preclude Mr. Dahl's testimony as an expert. And in response, we said, we're not offering him as an expert. In fact, this is a quote. Mr. Dahl was identified in Western National's initial disclosures as an individual with knowledge of the post-fire excavation of the site, specifically including the excavation of Galaxy's basement space. Mr. Dahl will provide factual testimony as to his observations during the course of the excavation. And that's exactly what he did. He didn't offer an opinion as to the value of anything. He didn't offer.
So can you, in the time you've got remaining, address the question of prejudice then? Because Nancy Jacobson testified to the exact same things. There was one file cabinet. I mean, the issue with that testimony, with Mr. Dahl's testimony, was were there 5 filing cabinets packed full of new cell phones? Or was there the one? How was your client prejudiced?
Because the jury could infer that Nancy Jacobson's testimony wouldn't have been as good as Mr. Dahl's because she did not go down into the excavation the same way that he did. And she would be subject to cross-examination by saying you observe from a distance and maybe you miss things, as opposed to the fact that Mr. Dahl actually entered the excavation itself, which Ms. Jacobson didn't.
But wasn't Ms. Jacobson there when stuff was lifted out? So she said, yeah, there was only one file cabinet out.
So, again, Your Honor, this is an area of speculation as to whether Ms. Jacobson's testimony would have been believed by the jury with the same credibility as Mr. Dahl's. But it's undisputed by the fact that Mr. Dahl's knowledge was more direct than that of Ms. Jacobson, and it was error to preclude her.
All right.
In the 14 seconds I've got left, I want to make one point. Your Honor is exactly right that the policy contains no limit for coverage for buildings. And the case law is clear that 65A08 should be read consistently with 65A01 and that it covers only buildings. And that case law is set forth in pages 31 and 32 of our reply brief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, thanks to everyone in this case. The matter has been well briefed and well argued. It's now submitted to this court for a decision. We will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you
again.
Thank you.